Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com.
Also, the Amanda Lester Detective book series for tweens and teens by former writing show producer and host Paula Berenstein. Introducing Sherlock Holmes to the next generation. Find out more at amandalester.net.
And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 96, A Study in Spring.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astrologer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Spring is in the air. What a great time.
It is a great time.
It is. Yeah. It is the best time to be here with us on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895.
Yes.
I'm Scott Monty.
Yes, and I'm Burt Wolder.
And what's that whiff I'm getting? You're all the way over in New Jersey.
Yes.
And we know New Jersey is the garden state.
Well, then it must be manure. It's the only thing I can think of. Or else it's a presidential campaign. But no, seriously.
Oh, boy.
It's because it's spring and we are celebrating spring. And when we celebrate spring, I know what you do. I know what I do. I immediately leap to my bookshelves and pick out some poetry by Christopher Morley, who wrote this poem, Burning Leaves in Spring. And it goes like this. When withered leaves are lost in flame, their eddying ghosts, a thin blue haze, blow through the thickets whence they came, on amber-lucent autumn days. The cool green woodland heart receives their dim dissolving phantom breath. In young hereditary leaves they see their happy life in death. My minutes perish as they glow, time burns my crazy bonfire through. But ghosts of blackened hours still blow eternal beauty back to you.
That's lovely.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, that's one of those hidden gems.
Yeah, and that was collected, for those of you who are running off to ABE Books right now, that was collected in Chimney Smoke in 1921. That was one of his...
How appropriate.
Yes, see Chris Morley's poetry collections.
Excellent.
So that's spring in a breath. There you are.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of literary things, I was roaming around on Twitter the other day.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I hope you didn't hurt, hurt your shins.
It's easy to get lost there. A couple of the birds flew by.
Ow.
They missed me.
I always get gum on the bottom of my shoes when I do that.
That happens. Yeah. That happens.
I think it's gone.
You know,
anyway.
It's Twitter. It only lasts for a short while, yes. So you don't have to worry about it. But there was a trending hashtag that was remove a letter, spoil a book. There were some pretty clever titles out there. Let me see if I can find Ma and Superman. One Baby Gone.
Oh, boy, that's good.
Let's see. Curious Gorge. Here's Waldo. Completely ruins it in that case.
Here's Wes.
I started thinking, well, what What could we do? What could we add to this in terms of the Sherlockian world? Yeah. In terms of the books that we know from Conan Doyle.
Oh, right.
So you want to lay any on me that you think might come to you off the top of your head?
Oh, well, The Creeping Ma.
The Creeping Ma. That is creepy.
Yeah.
That's a good one. And in that same vein, The Cooked Man.
Oh, The Cooked Man. Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
Or The Geek Interpreter. But some of the ones I threw out on the I Hear of Sherlock handle were A Stud in Scarlet.
Oh, very good.
The Baker Street Babes seemed to like that one. They didn't think it would spoil the book. The Sign of Fur.
Oh, I like that.
And, you know, Conan Doyle, of course, inspired The Mummy with his short story Lot 249. Maybe this could have inspired The Wolfman.
Yes.
A Sign of the Fur. Right. And rounding out the novels that we could play with, because The Hound of the Baskervilles doesn't really lend itself too well to removing a letter.
No.
I mean, you could say The Hound of the Askervilles, but that's pretty meaningless. We thought the Alley of Fear. I've been in a few of those in New York.
Yeah.
Or you could turn it around and do the Valley of Ear. Not quite as ominous. The
Valley of Ear.
And my personal favorite, His Last Owl.
Ow.
Yeah.
Ow. I got to go ow. Oh, that's great. We should have done that as a quiz. Or as a quiz qualifier.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
We should have collected them.
Maybe we'll think about that for another one. Hmm. You know, these quizzes, and we do have one this episode, they are they're mentally taxing.
Yes, they are.
But we have Nick Martorelli to help us out every now and again. He's an excellent quiz master. But we've been running so quickly in between episodes lately, we haven't had time to really get our ducks in a row with Nick. We got to get back on schedule there.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we'll have him do a special one for the 100th
episode. The 100th episode.
About that.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. And we've been getting a few recommendations in from our listeners as to what to do for our 100th episode.
Yes, I've seen some of those. Very ambitious.
They are. They are, you know, like a multi-cast member reading of a Sherlock Holmes radio play.
Yeah.
Which could be fun, but
it's something you really should do, you know, live, I think.
I agree. I think that would be a lot of fun if we did it.
Yeah.
You know, kind of a live audience, roundtable reading kind of thing.
Yeah. Maybe we could do something at Chautauqua.
That's not bad. Not a bad idea. I mean, not part of our presentation, certainly, but
no.
You know, something off the cuff in one of the breaks.
Bring the mics. Yeah,
that'd
why
be
not?
Interesting. So, yeah, so if you still have recommendations for us for the 100th episode, what you think we might do, there's still time.
Yes.
There's still time left. We will be recording that episode probably sometime in late June, and it'll be airing in July. So let us know. Leave us a comment on the website. Shoot us an email, comment@ihearofsherlock.com. There is an event that we set up on our Facebook page. If you go to facebook.com/IHearOfSherlock. By the way, if you don't like us already on Facebook, please do. That would be a great help. But in the events section on our Facebook page, there is a 100th episode event. It's not an actual event. It's just something that we can all kind of center the conversation around. So you can leave a comment there.
Very good. Yeah, more the merrier. And thank you to all of you who've already sent in suggestions. That's really great.
Yeah. So we will see. So, before we delve into the topic for today, we do have a sponsor.
No.
Talk about.
Well, no, impossible.
You know.
Is it Wrigley's Spearmint Gum? Is it Petri Wine? Is it Pepsodent toothpaste?
Because you're getting warmer.
They've done such a great job with Bob Hope. I'm hoping we can pick them up as a sponsor.
Wow.
Oh. You know, I want to tell you.
No, it is the Wessex Press, the premier publisher for books about Sherlock Holmes. WessexPress.com is where you may find them. And we do have, we've talked with the authors of A Curious Collection of Dates on our last episode. That was like one large infomercial for Wessex Press. We talked with Lamy and Gia. that's about the kind of day I'm having.
Isn't that an Italian car? Yeah, that's the kind of day I'm having too. I got me a new Lamy and Gia. You
know? Yes.
So you've got a nice V8 engine, but it doesn't go very fast.
or Jamie and Leah, as they're currently known, about their excellent work. A Curious Collection of Dates. But there are other things.
You mean there's more?
No, there's plenty more. I mean, if you want to delve into the archives of our friends at the Wessex Press, you could find, how about the complete Baker Street Ballads by Charles Lauterbach. Mm. Charles Lauterbach was a Baker Street irregular, and he created a great number of lighthearted and humorous poems about Sherlock Holmes that were published in the BSJ. And in 1971, those poems, along with some new material, were collected in this volume called Baker Street Ballads. And there was a second edition, or a second collection, I should say, that was made in 1979 called More Baker Street Ballads.
Oh, even more.
And then Henry Lauritsen, who recently, I don't know how recently it was, but I think he recently passed away. Maybe I'm thinking of the guy in Sweden. I'm getting my Scandinavians mixed up. Shame on me.
Yes.
Henry Lauritsen, I think, has been gone for a while.
Yes.
He's from the Sherlock Holmes Club of Denmark. He actually put some illustrations to all of these Baker Street ballads, and they got collected into the complete Baker Street Ballads. So you've got both long out of print original collections together in this previously unpublished volume. So check it out. If you're into poetry, if you're into Sherlock Holmes, and we hope you are, over at WessexPress.com under the Sherlockian Writings, Scholarly and Humorous. I think this would fall under the humorous category of the WessexPress.com.
Yes. Very good.
Yeah.
It's so nice. You know, I mean, when I was first getting involved in things Sherlockian, the whole idea, I mean, other than the Baker Street Journal, the whole idea of people putting, I mean, when a book of essays would come out, it was a huge event.
And
and there were only, you know, maybe one or two of those sorts of events every year. And now, you know, you've got this wonderful body of literature. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But there's one thing that makes spring complete for me and makes every Sunday a treat for me. All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park.
Well, strains of that fine tune mean that it is springtime here on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Hmm.
And well, technically it's springtime everywhere in the upper hemisphere, in the northern hemisphere.
Hmm. But not in Australia where you were.
No, I was recently in Australia, and we do have an audio clip at the end of the show that will preview our next episode, which will be Australian in nature.
Oh, good day.
But you'll have to stay tuned for that one, mate.
Yeah.
But of course, down in Sydney now, they're entering into the winter. You know, it's autumn, and they're getting ready to brace for winter in Sydney, which brings temperatures I don't know, all the way down to maybe 60.
Ooh.
That's sweater weather for them.
Scary.
That's shorts weather here in Michigan. But we thought, well, what a great opportunity to reflect on springtime in the canon.
Hmm.
And as a matter of fact, we asked for our qualifying question for mental exaltation, which you'll hear later in the show. The question we asked was, how many stories, according to the chronology by William Baring Gould, were set in the springtime? You know what the answer is or was? Well, it still is, I guess.
10.
10. That's an excellent guess. You know, springtime isn't a season that you might normally think of when it comes to Baker Street. You think maybe winter, you know, around the crackling fire, or you think autumn, you know, with, you know, the tales like the Hound of the Baskervilles and whatnot. But it turns out, according to Baring Gould, there were only 10 stories set in winter.
Oh, no, 10 in winter.
There were 14 in autumn. There were 20 in the summer. Which I found really astounding. I didn't really stop to think about that. And there were 16 in the spring.
Yeah.
Some of the surprises to me, in terms of the summertime setting, were, let me see. Yeah, the man with the twisted lip, I never really thought about that just offhand, but thinking the way that, rolled out, I would have thought, yeah, spring or autumn would be reasonable. What else? The resident patient, the Greek interpreter, the naval treaty. Those were all summertime adventures as well. Odd.
Well, spring, you know, spring in England. Michael Flanders, the British lyricist and comedian, said in one of his evening performances with the composer Donald Swann, spring, it's a lovely season. I missed it last year. I was in the bathroom.
It sounds about right. It sounds sounds an awful lot like summer around here.
Yeah.
Lately.
So but, you don't really think, you know, much about spring.
No.
As a season or really anything.
And there are a few tales that to me kind of stand out as far as spring goes. And I think the first one I would mention, and we're not going to go through every one of the 16 stories here. I mean, we can certainly rattle off what they all are. And we can do that in the show notes. But I thought it might be interesting if we just commented on some of the springtime stories that have some kind of personal connection with us for some reason or another. And, the first one that comes to mind, and perhaps this is because, I think it was one of the first episodes that I saw with Jeremy Brett in the starring role. And because, this organization only meets once a year in the springtime, usually around late April or early May. And that is the Speckled Band.
Ah, yes, the Speckled Band. Yeah.
Baring Gould said that the Speckled Band took place on April 6th, 1883.
A good date.
As good as any, right? Happy birthday. there were actually a lot of April stories in this in this rundown. Wonderful quote when Holmes and Watson were setting out for Stoke Moran. Watson wrote, "At Waterloo, we were fortunate in catching a train for Leatherhead, where we hired a trap at the station inn and drove for 4 or 5 miles through the lovely Surrey lanes. It was a perfect day with a bright sun and a few fleecy clouds in the heavens. The trees and wayside hedges were just throwing out their first green shoots, and the air was full of the pleasant smell of the moist earth. To me, at least, there was a strange contrast between the sweet promise of the spring and this sinister quest upon which we were engaged. My companion sat in front of the trap, his arms folded, his hat pulled down over his eyes, and his chin sunk upon his breast, buried in the deepest thought."
Oh, that's very good.
Yeah. And, of course, earlier in the story, we had Grimsby Roylott making his way into Baker Street, unannounced, unexpected, and whatnot, and, you know, trying to get some information out of Sherlock Holmes. And of course, Holmes would have nothing of it. You know, he comes in. I'm Dr. Grimsby Royal out of Stoke Moran. Indeed, doctor, said Holmes blandly. Pray take a seat. I will do nothing of the kind. My stepdaughter has been here. I have traced her. What has she been saying to you? It is a little cold for the time of year. What has she been saying to you? But I've heard the crocuses promise well, continued my companion imperturbably. Ah, you put me off, do you? Said our visitor, taking a step forward, shaking his hunting crop. I know you, you scoundrel. I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, my friend smiled. Holmes the busybody. Holmes the busybody. His smile broadened. Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office. Ha! Holmes chuckled hardly. Your conversation is most entertaining. When you go out, please close the door, for there is a decided draft.
Oh, it's a great scene.
You'll, of course, recognize that clip from our intro piece, right, with Jeremy Brett.
Yeah.
And
Charles, was that Charles?
Jeremy Kemp. Jeremy Kemp.
Well, that was Jeremy Kemp? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't remember that. I thought it was Charles. Charles, what's his name? Who played Mycroft?
No. That was, Charles Gray said, I hear Sherlock everywhere since you became his
father. Oh, that's right. No, that's right. Yes.
But I've heard of you before.
That was Jeremy Kemp.
Hmm. That's Jeremy Kemp as Grimsby Roylott. Hmm. And of course, he was also, the villain
in 7%.
7% Solution.
Yeah.
Right? No backhand.
Yeah.
Left us far too soon.
Well, that's great. And in fact,
is he still with us?
Jeremy Kemp?
He is, actually. I thought he passed away.
He may well be.
Oh, my gosh. Peter Calamai is going to have a field day with this. You get us, Peter? That's a private joke. but, yeah, he's still with us. It's Charles Gray who is not.
Huh.
So there you go. So that was one of my favorites right off the bat, was finding the Speckled Band as a springtime story.
Hmm.
What about you? Any from the list appeal to you or speak out in some way?
Well, the band, too. I was just up at the Speckled Band meeting in Boston, which was great. Sadly, we missed Dan Pisnansky there, and we missed John Constable, who were otherwise incommoded. But it was a very, very good meeting. The other stories, you know, it's just when I think of the canon, it's far down on the list that I think about the season that the story took place in. But I always have the Baring Gould chronology handy, so I just looked. Mm-hmm. And I do see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 stories happened in April.
Yeah.
And of those, Solitary Cyclist, Three Students, Yellow Face, Copper Beaches, Rigate Squires, Speckled Band. But somewhat uniquely, both The Final Problem and Empty House.
Yes, that is true.
Happen in April. And so I suppose those loom very large. I mean, Final Problem.
That's when we get the whole timeline from Professor Moriarty, right?
Yeah.
You crossed my path on the 4th of January.
Right.
Speaking of being incommoded, on the 23rd, you incommoded me.
Luckily, I was able to have my commode repaired, but at considerable inconvenience, Mr. Holmes.
Yeah. By the middle of February, I was seriously inconvenienced by you. At the end of March, I was absolutely hampered in my plans. See, Holmes was messing with his bathroom habits and with his laundry habits.
His commode and hampered. His hamper. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Commoded and hampered.
Yeah. Hmm.
And now at the close of April, I find myself in such a position through your continual persecution that I am in positive danger of losing my liberty.
Hmm.
So that the final problem took place between April 24th and May 4th, 1891.
Hmm.
And as you note, interestingly enough, Holmes returned in April of 1894,
mm-hmm.
April 5th, 1894.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the spring of the year 1894 that all London was interested in the fashionable world dismayed by the murder of the Honorable Ronald Adair under the most unusual and inexplicable circumstances. And, of course, the author and pseudo-scholar Samuel Rosenberg had a field day with this in Naked is the Best Disguise, saying that, you know, this was during the Easter period, you know, during Lent. And it was a tale of resurrection. And like the classic Christian story of resurrection, Holmes too came back. And, of course, had to come back in the spring.
Well, he had to come back. He would have been late for the Seder.
So that was that's an excellent one there too. And you know, the other thing is that having read that Speckled Band passage just brings to mind how effective Conan Doyle was at setting a scene.
Yeah.
And his descriptive prose.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking exactly that. In fact, it's even more than that. You know, that was a great extract for you to pick out where Watson says, you know, we took the train, we hired a trap, we drove for 4 or 5 miles. It was a perfect day. He describes the day. He describes how he felt, you know, a contrast between the smell of the moist earth and the sinister quest upon which we were engaged. And then at the end of that, he gives you the picture of Holmes. My companion sat in the front of the trap, his arms folded as if, you know, and so just look at what's going on in that paragraph. What's going on, you know, is that you believe in the absolute verisimilitude of the narrator. You know, it's completely honest. You follow his reasoning. It's almost as if you're looking through his eyes. You see him go from the countryside down to his companion who's sort of sunk in this state. So you have the narrator's perspective. Here's why I'm telling you the story. You can really trust me. You have this wonderful contrast between the scene and Holmes. It's just a beautiful little thing. Really is beautiful.
It absolutely is. You know, this is, and again, you know, when you think to the classics like The Hound of the Baskervilles, Conan Doyle was able to make the moor, as we mentioned with Bert Cools in episodes 68 and 69, make the moor a character, story. Very effective as far as that description goes, really bringing it to life and making the reader feel as if he or she is in that spot, sharing side by side, shoulder to shoulder with Holmes and Watson, the vistas and the smells and the feeling and all the rest of what goes along with being in a setting like that. You know, interestingly, in one of the other stories, A Solitary Cyclist that you mentioned, and this is April of 1895. You know, there are so many of the classic stories from the return of Sherlock Holmes that took place in 1895. And Solitary Cyclist was one of them, according to Baring Gould. And probably according to Watson here, because it says, on referring to my notebook for the year 1895, I find that it was upon Saturday, the 23rd of April, that we first heard of Miss Violet Smith. So there you go, as far as that dating. But Watson, interestingly here, has, again, some wonderful descriptions in terms of the countryside. But Holmes, in this case, seems to be less concerned with any kind of impending doom. You know, he seems to be footloose and fancy free. Watson says, a rainy night had been followed by a glorious morning. And the heath-covered countryside with the glowing clumps of flowering gorse seemed all the more beautiful to eyes which were weary of the duns and drabs and slate grays of London. Holmes and I walked along the broad, sandy road, inhaling the fresh morning air and rejoicing in the music of the birds and the fresh breath of the spring. So it's as if the two of them were together, kind of enjoying the surroundings rather than Holmes being all gloom and doom.
Yeah.
And perhaps that was a factor of the case. Holmes in The Speckled Band probably had a sense as to what was happening after hearing that horrifying story from Helen Stoner. In The Solitary Cyclist, it was still a little bit loose in terms of what was happening.
Hmm. Very good.
Yeah. And, you know, one of my favorites as far as the springtime goes, I always think of as far as springtime because it's part of the academic calendar and because of the a certain phrase that's mentioned in it is the three students, which according to Baring Gould took place in early April, April 5th to 6th, 1895. And you know what? Before I get to that favorite quote, I want to talk about the deduction that went into place with, or that played out as far as Baring Gould is concerned. Because if you have the original annotated Sherlock Holmes, which upon which Les Klinger's version was based, you've got these wonderful notes about the dates of the stories, and Baring Gould takes you through the processes that he went through in order to lock down these dates. Hmm. And let's see. In this one, he mentioned that was Watson mentioned it was already twilight when we reached the scene of our problem. And upon that line, there's a note. It's on page 372 of volume 2 of the annotated Sherlock Holmes. If you have the 2-volume version in front of you, it says it was at 4:30 that Hilton Soames said that he left the proof upon his desk and was absent for more than an hour. Thus, he returned to his room after 5:30. He found a key in his door and the examination papers tampered with. He called and questioned Bannister, gave him brandy, made a most careful examination of the room, and he then came straight around to put the matter into Holmes's hands and poured forth his story. All of this, especially the most careful examination of Soames's room, took time. He can hardly have concluded his story much before 6:30, after which Holmes and Watson went directly to St. Luke's, evidently a short walk from their lodgings. Okay. We conclude that twilight on that day must have fallen close to 6:40 p.m. It can hardly have been much later, for Holmes said, it is nearly 9 at the close of the investigation. That included a careful examination of Soames's room, interviews with Bannister, Gilchrist, and Dalat Ross, an attempt to visit McLaren, and calls on the four stationers. The term, as we shall see, was the Lent term. This ended at Oxford on April 6th, at Cambridge on March 27th in the year 1895. March 27th is too early in the year for twilight at approximately 6:40 p.m., and therefore indicates to your editor that the university of the three students was Oxford, not Cambridge. Twilight close to 6:40 p.m. indicates the latest possible date in Oxford's Lent term. In addition, it is our opinion that the Fortescue examination would most probably be given on the closing day of the term, Saturday, April 6th, 1895. We conclude that the case ended on that day and began on the preceding day, Friday, April 5th, a day on which the sun set and twilight began at 6:37 p.m.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff that Sherlockian legends are made of. Yeah. Just amazing. Amazing stuff. But, you know, my favorite quote that I will always remember, and maybe it's because I spent time planning Sherlockian dinners in my previous life before I had one. you know, because you always look to the stories for cues as to what you should serve for dinner. You know, I'm working with the chef on the menu and whatnot. And, of course, the famous quote from the three students is, by Jove, my dear fellow, it is nearly 9, and the landlady babbled of green peas at 7:30. And just a classic there. Hmm. Not that you get too many green peas in England during that time as early as April. Usually those are more June or July. But that to me just always triggers that notion of spring and the green peas.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. And speaking of green peas, I'm reminded of a classic, if you'll indulge me for just a moment.
Of course.
We know a remote farm in Lincolnshire where Mrs. Buckley lives. Every July, peas grow there. Do you really mean that?
So in other words, I'd start half a second late.
Don't you think you really want to say July over the snow? Isn't that the fun of it?
If you can make it almost when that shot disappears, it'll make my...
I think it's so nice that you see a snow-covered field and say every July peas grow there. We know a remote farm in Lincolnshire where Mrs. Buckley lives. Every July, peas grow there. We aren't even in the fields, you see.
Yeah, we are.
We're talking about them growing and she's picked them.
Yeah.
What?
In July.
I don't understand you then. What must be over for July?
When we get out of that snowy field.
When I was out, we were onto a can of peas, a big dish of peas when I said in July.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, always. I'm always past that.
You are?
Yes. Well, that's about where I say in July.
Can you emphasize a bit in July?
Why? That doesn't make any sense. Sorry. There's no known way of saying an English sentence in which you begin a sentence with in and emphasize it. Get me a jury and show me how you can say in July and I'll go on you. That's just idiotic, if you'll forgive me by saying so. That's just stupid. In July. I'd love to know how you emphasize in and in July. Impossible. Meaningless.
I think all they were thinking about was that they didn't want to...
He isn't thinking.
Listen, can we just do one last...
Yeah?
And it was my fault. I said in July. If you can leave every July...
You didn't say it. He said it. Your friend. Every July? No, you don't really mean every July.
It is. No,
but that's the best bad copy. It's in July. Of course it's every July. There's too much directing around here. Norway. Fish fingers, Findus, Norway. We know a certain fjord in Norway, near where the cod gather in great shoals. There, Jan Stangeland.
A fraction more on that shoals thing, because you roll it around very nicely.
Yeah, roll it around, and I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against, because it's full of things that are only correct because they're grammatical, but they're tough on the ear. You see, this is a very wearying one. It's unpleasant to read, unrewarding. Because Findus freeze the cod at sea and then add a crumb crisp coating. That's tough, crumb crisp coating. I think, no, because of the way it's written, you need to break it up because it's not as conversationally written. What?
Take crumb out.
Good. Here under protest is beef burgers. We know a little place in the American Far West where Charlie Briggs chops up the finest prairie-fed beef and tastes... This is a lot of shit, you know that. You want one more?
Yeah.
More on what beef?
You missed the first beef, actually, completely.
What do you mean, missed it?
You're emphasizing prairie-fed.
But you can't emphasize beef. That's like he's wanting me to emphasize in before July. Come on, fellas, you're losing your heads. I wouldn't direct any living actor like this in Shakespeare. Will you do this? It's impossible.
Orson, you did six last year, and by far and away the best, and I know the reason.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving it.
At the moment.
I spent 20 times more for you people than any other commercial I've ever made. You are such pests. Now, what is it you want?
No, I think...
In your depths of your ignorance, what is it you want? Whatever it is you want, I can't deliver because I just don't see it.
That was absolutely fine. It really was.
You can give me worth it. No money is worth it.
It's a classic.
It is a classic. Now, I don't know. You know, I know you're familiar with that, but I don't know if you're familiar with something that was pulled out of the archives, a recent discovery of an Orson Welles outtake related to that green pea commercial.
Rosebud. Yes, rosebud frozen peas. Full of country goodness and green penis. Wait, that's terrible. I quit. Just a handful for the road. Oh, what luck. There's a French fry stuck in my beard. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yes. Oh, yes.
Now, what is his name who does Pinky?
That's the brain. Maurice LaMarche.
Right. Maurice LaMarche, right. Brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant.
Yes. Yes. Always.
But you know, you really needed all of that poundage to have that resonance.
I know.
That magnificent resonance of Orson Welles.
The French champagne. classic stuff.
That's very funny. I had not heard the Pinky and the Brain one. Big fan of Pinky.
Well, that was Orson Welles appearing in an episode of The Critic with John Lovett says something or other, The Critic. He appeared in an outtake at a film festival as Orson Welles.
Who did?
Maurice LaMarche.
Oh,
That wasn't. He uses the same voice for Pinky, he was actually doing
for the brain. Yeah,
Orson Welles,
and in fact, the Welles, that outtake of Welles, which is really stitched together from a much longer voiceover session that Welles did. That was his inspiration for the voice of the brain.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's great.
Rosebud. Full of country goodness and grief. Oh, my goodness. Well, before we close out the books on this topic, any other springtime stories that speak to you?
Oh, I think we've covered them.
I just wanted to bring up one more.
Mm.
And this is one of those things that, you know, it gets sneaked in a way. Mm. Wisteria Lodge. Watson dated this. He says, I find it recorded in my notebook that it was a bleak and windy day toward the end of March mm-hmm. in the year 1892. What's wrong with this date?
Well, obviously, in 1892, our hero was not about. So as Baron Gould points out, it must have been in 1890.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And, you know, there are, I think, just a handful of times where Watson plays fast and loose with the dates that makes the chronologist's head spin. I think the Red-Headed League is one where it opens in, is it open in June or April? And then suddenly it's October and the next week.
Right.
And then, I think they had trouble with, the Sign of Four at one point or another too. That was, kind of fast and loose with dates there.
Well, you know, Sign of Four should not have been all that challenging because, of course, we know when it was published, and so it must have happened before it was published.
Well, true. The year was fine. It's either 1887 or 1888, most of the chronologists agree. Mm. And the canon itself says July 7th or September 1888. But if you go down a list of chronologists, you know, some had it. Some agreed that it was in September, although they thought it might have been September 1887, and others placed it squarely in July of 88. There's one that even put it in July of 87.
Hmm.
So lots of conflicts here. There's one, Zeisler. Ernest Zeisler actually put it in April of 1888.
Good God.
Defying the canon and all of the other chronologists.
Hmm.
So weird stuff. Wild, wacky stuff.
Very wacky.
Oh. Wicky, wacky, woo. Well, I guess that means we're on to sponsor number two. And who is the lucky sponsor for number two?
You mean there's a second sponsor?
We try.
Could it be the Baker Street Journal?
Why, yes, it could. It could indeed.
Now, have you gotten your copy of the Baker Street Journal?
I just got it yesterday.
I have not received mine yet.
Oh, boy.
So. Now I'm on that end of the mailing list. So there.
Well, it's a lovely, well done, tightly bound issue again.
Really? Well, tell me, what color is the cover?
Go figure. It is goldenrod.
How spring-like.
Yeah. You've got volume 66, number one, spring 2016. Mm. On the cover is Ian McKellen posing in front of the door at 221B Baker Street.
Oh.
And this is Ian McKellen in his top hat, in his flashback time frame in the movie Mr. Holmes. But The volume itself is largely, well, not largely, but partially dedicated to goings on at the BSI weekend, what happened there, including Jeffrey Hatcher's lecture. He was the
he was the distinguished speaker.
Yeah, the 2016 BSI distinguished speaker, and he of course wrote the screenplay to Mr. Holmes. And were you in the audience for his talk?
No, I was
not. Oh, you missed a really good one. And, you know, having it written out is certainly helpful, but actually being there, because he was so entertaining, it was really, really well done. So you've got his full speech there in the spring issue of the BSJ. And Jeffrey Hatcher, speaking of which, will actually be at the Chautauqua Institute in September for the Art and Mind of Sherlock Holmes conference.
Oh, well.
So if you missed him at the BSI weekend, there's a chance to see him again in upstate New York instead.
Yes, and if I want to reserve for that particular conference after Labor Day in September of this year, it's open to all, and you can reserve now. Just go to bakerstreetjournal.com and click through.
Perfect. And while you're there, make sure you get a subscription, too. The Baker Street Journal.
Get two subscriptions.
That would do it.
Get three or four.
Yeah, maybe, be generous while you're, just go around scattering them about you as you go about your business.
Yeah. I mean, frequently I carry a couple of extra copies of the Baker Street Journal with me and give them to people who are panhandling on the streets of New York. And I feel better for it.
I wondered what all that muttering was as I was walking with you through New York.
And so will you. You'll feel better for it.
Ah, the global beat. I mean only one thing. Someone's being beaten about the sound studio.
It's time for Advil.
Well, that means it's time for news.
News, hooray!
Yeah, there's some interesting things. Not too many, because we don't want to overburden you with things. We want to try and keep this as current as possible. But things you may have missed on iHearOfSherlock.com, our fine website. Mm. We covered a discovery that came our way thanks to some fans on Facebook of a TED Ed lesson. I know, Bert, you're certainly familiar with TED Talks.
Yeah.
That's technology, education, and design. Some wonderful talks from inspirational people from around the globe. Lots of great things to discover on TED.com. Well, they have an educational division, an area that anyone can submit content to and create their own TED Ed lesson. And in this case, we discovered that there was someone who created a lesson called Who is the Real Sherlock Holmes? Or Who is Sherlock Holmes? And it was created by an educator, Neil McCaw, with assistance from Lasse Rutzau-Brunzi, the director, from Tobias Dahl-Nielsen for sound design, and Stephen LaRosa as the composer. And there you'll find about a five-minute or so video that runs you through probably many of the things you as a Sherlockian already know. But they also have modules where you can learn more and dig deeper and think about this area and even discuss it with other like-minded individuals. So that is one of the things we reported on because we just thought it was so interesting.
Yeah, I like that. I like the fact that there's a quiz in there that ranges from open-ended questions to other things, but it points out that in the 19th century, at this time, people were beginning to use scientific techniques to help them investigate crime. And, of course, that was a fundamental building block in creating Sherlock Holmes. And also they have a great bunch of links there to the Conan Doyle collection and the University of Minnesota collection and the Toronto Public Library. So it's a lovely thing and helpful to people who are just discovering Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
So if you have children who are doing that, you might well check out IHearOfSherlock.com and look at that TED Ed lesson there and click through.
That's a great suggestion. What else do we have? Also on our site, Derek Belanger, once again, doing the yeoman's work here, sitting down and interviewing, by email at least, every one of the authors in the latest volume of the largest collection of new Sherlock Holmes stories, the MX Book of New Sherlock Holmes Stories, Part 4. I guess this is the 2016 volume. It seems like they're going to do a new volume every year for as long as they can get people to keep writing fan fiction. And it is, of course, for the benefit of the restoration of Undershaw. All of the proceeds go toward Undershaw. Derek sat down with all of the authors, and I think there are probably a good dozen or so, and interview them about what it is that they wrote and why, and you know, gave you a link to some of their other works and whatnot. So check that out.
Great job, Derek.
Yeah. And we'll have links to all of these news items in the show notes.
Yep. And you can go back in time because we also reported the excerpts from an interview with Jeremy Brett that appeared back in 1985. Which is really a lot of fun. Were you ever a reader of The Armchair Detective?
I was. I had a couple of the issues. Yeah.
Yeah. Me too, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's still published. It's probably still published.
That's a good question. But, you know, the interview here on thelineup.com is very much in the spirit of that kind of deep dive.
Yeah.
With Brett. I don't think there were any new insights here. Maybe just said in a slightly different way than he said them in other interviews, but that was the first time I saw that one.
No, but the nice thing about it is that the interviewer asked Brett all the questions that you would probably ask Brett if you were meeting him and the series was just starting. You know, what do you think about this? What do you think about that?
Yeah.
And also he had some things that if I ever knew, I'd long forgotten. He commented about Scanlon Bohemia and working with Gail Honeycutt and identified a scent that she wore, Bluebell by Panhaligon.
Yes.
And he says Holmes, you know, was momentarily disoriented by this scent. And I just love that. I just thought that was fascinating and adorable.
I mean, nothing that you would ever pick up as far as watching the show, but the fact that they went to that level of detail in the production was really something.
Yeah, and then he remembered the scent. My goodness.
Yeah.
And then he quotes John Mortimer, you know, who wrote – the late John Mortimer, who wrote Rumpole of the Bailey and other things. I just thought the whole thing was fascinating.
Really. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Telegraph also had a piece, speaking of going back in time, Arthur Conan Doyle, 19 Things You Didn't Know. And my initial thought or reaction in seeing a headline like that was, try me. Just try me, right? And there actually was one thing I didn't know about this.
One?
About Conan Doyle. Just one out of the 19.
No.
We don't have to run down all of them. Conan Doyle was one of the earliest motorists in Britain. Mm-hmm. We knew that. And we talked about in the last episode of him turning his car over or getting a speeding ticket. I can't remember which it was. He was on the same cricket team as J.M. Barrie. Mm-hmm. Knew that. He could have discussed Dracula and Treasure Island with their authors, right? Because he was friends with Bram Stoker and Robert Louis Stevenson. Knew that one. Ran for parliament twice. Right? Knew that one. Uh-huh. He was too fat to fight. The reason he couldn't become a soldier in the Boer War was because he was overweight. Instead, he volunteered as a ship's doctor and sailed to Africa.
I'd like to see the proof of that. I mean, not that he was overweight, but
he was under tall.
He was over 50. When was the Boer? Wasn't he like 50 years old? I mean, he wouldn't have been. Made it into the.
Well, no, he would have been. He was born in what, 1859? So he would have been. He would have been in his early 40s. Really isn't too old.
Hmm.
You know, they had older soldiers back then. But look, he was a big man anyway. He was tall.
Yeah.
And he was broad shouldered. I mean, it's likely that he would have.
He was big boned.
Yeah. Don't go with that cliche.
With big bone.
I knew somebody was going to go there. I was specifically trying to avoid that. It anyway.
Yeah, there you go. I didn't know that he died holding a flower. Now that
follow
those things.
I knew that one. What I did not know is where was it? He shares his birthday with Wagner.
With Wagner, yeah, that.
Yeah. I did not know that. Also with Laurence Olivier, singer Morrissey, model Naomi Campbell, and tennis player Novak Djokovic.
Novak Djokovic. That's no Djokovic.
Hey, you're telling me.
Yeah. Speaking of birthdays, I was very pleased, and maybe this has happened in prior years, but I hadn't noticed it. Mm. But, you know, Garrison Keillor does the Writer's Almanac broadcast. He does 5 minutes every day of literary events around a particular day. And on May 5th, he had a lovely series of remarks about Christopher Morley.
Oh.
And I don't remember him talking about Morley in prior years, but maybe he's done that historically. But I thought that was grand. Yeah.
He'd do anything for George Lucas on May 4th?
I don't remember.
I doubt George Lucas counts as literate or literary.
May the 4th, yeah.
Let's see. We also have a piece on the site about scintillation of scions. Of course, you know, we've talked about scintillation of scions before as one of the great annual events that you can go to and should go to.
Boy, I wish there was a discount.
Well, funny you should ask,
what?
Bert.
What?
Why, for our listeners.
You're kidding.
And our readers, if they go to scintillation.org, and there are links to that in case you have trouble spelling scintillation, and you give them the code IHOS10 when you're checking out, that will save you 10%. On your registration for this conference, which takes place June 10th through 11th in the greater Baltimore area. It is a fun event. It's both fun and scholarly, right? You'll get things to think about, but you'll also get just a wonderful program as Jacqueline Morris oversees now her ninth outing as the administrator behind Scintillation of Science, and she has a wonderful team that helps her organize all this stuff. There's a charity that's involved. The proceeds go to there's things to shop for there of Sherlockian nature. So you'll definitely want to see about going to Scintillation of Science 9. And I know, depending on the success of this one, they may mount a 10th anniversary special in 2017. Woo. So. You'll have to stay tuned for that. And then I guess we have one more. We've got a review of a book called A Study in Charlotte. This is by Brittany Cavallaro. And I ran into Brittany at the Baker Street Babes Daintiest Thing Pajama-gram ball in New York in January. And Brittany handed me a bookmark with A Study in Charlotte on it. Well, it turns out this is it's a book, not quite a pastiche, because this is a Sherlock Holmes story in which Sherlock Holmes doesn't even make an appearance. How about that? It's about a young girl named Charlotte Holmes. And she goes to a boarding school in modern day Connecticut, and her roommate is none other than Jamie Watson. This is,
They both meet at Sheringford School. Watson is there, of course, on a rugby scholarship. The two of them connect and experience some adventures there. And there was actually a very entertaining and, I thought, inventive video trailer that was put together to advertise the book. Hmm. That was an interesting way to go about marketing it. And Rob Nunn has written a review of that book on our site. So you'll certainly want to check that out. Hmm. Well, and speaking of young women at boarding schools, that can only, in my parlance, lead us to Amanda Lester, detective.
Oh, Amanda Lester.
yes, our sponsor, Paula Berenstein.
Hasn't she graduated yet?
No, she's still there.
Does she have a summer job?
Working.
Is she interning? Does she need?
She may be looking for a good internship, actually.
Can you send me her resume?
I'll bet we can.
Okay.
So you've got her starring in Amanda Lester and the Pink Sugar Conspiracy, the Orange Crystal Crisis, the Purple Rainbow Puzzle, and the Blue Peacock Secret. And you'll want to know about some of the characters in there. As we've been going through each episode here, we've been introducing you to some of those characters. And in this case, Scapulous Holmes is Sherlock's great-great-grandson. And Paula says because she wanted the world to mirror the real United Kingdom, she decided to make him a mixed-race kid. His father, Olamus Holmes, is a detective, and he's white. And his mother, get this, Pastiche Holmes, a botanist, is black. And Scapulous is a computing genius, an only child who's followed in his family's footsteps. So he enters the detective school in the second semester. He's coming into a group that's already established its dynamics. But of course, that's not going to faze him. He's self-assured and pleasant and an all-around good guy. Everyone likes him. Except Amanda Lester, who simply can't forgive him simply for being related to you-know-who. Mm. So you'll want to check that out in Amanda Lester and the Blue Peacock Secret. Go to amandalester.net.
My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere. Then I can dispense with artificial stimulants. But I abhor the dull routine of existence. I crave mental exaltation.
Ah, yes. Well, welcome to the I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere quiz program called Mental Exaltation. If you've ever listened to NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you will be familiar with our format. But just in case you haven't listened to those, each episode we post a qualifying question on our website, ihearofsherlock.com. And of all the correct answers submitted, an individual is chosen at random to become a contestant on Mental Exaltation. This time, we asked for the number of stories set in the spring, according to the chronology by William S. Baring Gould. And the correct answer, as you've already learned, was 16. So, Scott, who is our contestant this time?
Bert, please welcome Rob Nunn of Edwardsville, Illinois.
Oh, Rob Nunn from Edwardsville, Illinois. Come on down.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Excellent. Excellent. Now, you are a sometime contributor to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere on the blog side, right? You do a little writing?
Yeah, you guys have been unlucky enough to put me up there a couple of times already.
So what's your beat? What's your passion point around this?
Really pretty general. I've done a couple book reviews, but mostly just kind of finding my way into the Sherlockian universe is what I've posted about the most, I guess.
Excellent. Excellent. And how did you find your way into the universe? Where did you first meet Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, man. Probably like most people in my generation. I came from The Great Mouse Detective. But then back to the serial after that. It's just kind of always been around. I can't really pinpoint the original source. I remember reading a Michael Hardwick novel when I was in like sixth grade. But I've always been aware of Sherlock Holmes as a character, and I just got the complete canon 10 years ago and just fell in love with it.
That's fantastic. Well, do you think you're familiar enough with the canon to take on our quiz?
Well, I guess we're going to find out one way or the other, aren't we?
Okay. Well, if you listened last time, we're keeping the Limerick theme going. So this time, all of the Limericks are going to be about the spring, or at least about some of the stories that occurred in the spring, according to William Baring Gould. If you get two or more right, all you have to do is fill in the blank. We will send you a copy of A Curious Collection of Dates Through the Year with Sherlock Holmes by Leah Gwynn and Jamie Mahoney, who are our guests on episode 95. So, Rob, are you ready?
All right, let's try.
Shall the examination proceed? Yes, let it proceed by all means.
Three students were questioned by Holmes. Rhodesia is where now one roams. No more need to be mopey. His business is quite soapy. After establishing Gilchrist and...
Soames.
Well done. Well done. All right, second one.
Okay.
Robert Norberton's deeply in debt, so he needs every pound he can get. Holmes depends with tranquility on a dog's sure nobility, gets his clue from Bob's sister's loved...
Annette. I don't know.
Pet.
Hmm.
The dog. The dog was his sister's loved pet. Okay, so you've got...
All right.
You've got one out of two, so this is your chance to really bring it home. You know, if you get this right, the book is yours. If you don't, you go down in the annals of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere history as someone who lost one of the quizzes.
And yeah, am I going to be the first person?
You might. You might just.
No pressure. No pressure.
Stay with us. Stay with us. Moriarty, good God, how it galls that he lasts through the closest of calls. And when Holmes meets that prime, vile Napoleon of crime, both men die at the...
All right. The Reichenbach Falls.
There you go. Well done. Well done,
sir.
Pulled
out the last minute.
Well, I'm glad you kept us in suspense there. That was an important element of keeping the show going, right?
Well, you weren't the only one in suspense.
I love it. Well, thank you for participating, and we will be sure to send a copy of A Curious Collection of Dates your way, courtesy of our sponsors, the Wessex Press.
Great. I'm really looking forward to it.
All right.
Excellent.
Those peas are going to work already, I fear. It's gas lamp time.
The lights are dimming all across the country.
They are, and not because of a power outage in your area.
No. Just wait.
We'll see. Well, I thought that we might try to find a spring-themed gas lamp from a BSJ, past or present.
How clever.
And lo and behold, there really are no spring-themed gas lamps in the BSJ, past or present. However...
So, the game's afoot.
No, not quite. We do have quite a few issues of the Baker Street Journal that actually have a spring number.
Hmm.
And they used to be... some of them used to be dated as far as months ago. They were dated as March of the year, but at a certain point, I believe, into the late 90s or early 2000s, they went to seasonal datings. So you've got spring, summer, winter, and autumn, not in that order. Simply to give the editorial and publishing staff a little more leeway in terms of when the publication comes out. So technically, Bert, you still do have time to receive your spring issue.
I hope.
Before it expires. Because you do not want to leave the Baker Street Journal out uncovered after its season has gone by.
Well, as you well know, May 15th is Straw Hat Day, when we're supposed to begin wearing our straw hats. And I always cover my copy of the Baker Street Journal with a natty Panama hat.
See, there you go. There you go. That works. So I turn to the latest issue of the journal, which we just mentioned to you earlier on in the news section, in our sponsor section, actually. And I opened the page to the editor's gas lamp, and I found one titled, Consider Yourself One of the Family. Now, before I read the gas lamp, that phrase may seem familiar to you. For anyone who has seen or heard the musical Oliver, that is one of the songs. Consider yourself at home. Mm-hmm. Consider yourself one of the family. Well, I know of Steve Rothman's penchant for using lyrics from various songs, Broadway and otherwise, as titles for editors' gas lamps. And I thought I had seen Consider Yourself One of the Family in one of the previous issues of the journal.
Yeah.
Lo and behold, I go to volume 62, number 1, spring 2012. I open to the editor's gas lamp, and what do I find? Consider yourself at home.
Oh, how clever.
So he's continuing on 4 years later. Consider yourself one of the family.
What's the what's the next line in the lyric?
4 years hence, I think we'll see if we can, have.
Consider yourself part of the furniture.
That'll be the challenge for Steve. So, well, without further ado then, here is the editor's gas lamp from volume 66, number 1 of the Baker Street Journal, spring 2016. Back from the weekend surrounding the BSI dinner, we find ourselves once again filled with Sherlockian joy. Having attended dinners for almost 4 decades, we have seen many changes in the unchanging world of irregularity. The welcome addition of women to the ranks is the most obvious. The significant uptick of younger guests in recent years and younger irregulars promises that the future of the BSI will be vital. The BSI weekend demonstrates fully that the most important appeal of the canon is its celebration of the undying friendship between Sherlock Holmes and John Watson. Those who attend do their best to emulate that friendship. Beyond the formal dinners and luncheons are scores of impromptu gatherings, quiet drinks, coffees, and meals in groups large and small. It's impossible to spend enough time with enough people, but cheeks are kissed, hands are shook, hugs are delivered, and somehow the constant talk settles into a pattern, clearly perceived once one has returned home, of happiness. It's a family reunion with a family that one has sought to join and that has welcomed you into its midst. As with any family gathering, there can be downsides. The crazy uncle, the boring cousin, the peculiar food. But overall, it's shared memories, beliefs, and love that bind the group. We're all lucky, irregulars or not, to be able to climb those 17 steps and immerse ourselves in the greatest friendship since David and Jonathan.
Consider yourself at home. Consider yourself one of the family. We've taken to you so strong. It's clear
Well, it's very nice. How interesting, that David and Jonathan reference.
I almost said David and Goliath.
It was a very brief friendship.
Yeah. Cut short by a small stone. So we're toward the end of the show here. A few more things before we let you go.
Impossible.
Yeah, just a couple. One, we ask this of you every episode. But if you could actually take it to heart this time, if you haven't done so already, we would really appreciate it. And that is, could you go to iTunes, provide us a rating, or even better, a review? You know, with a rating, all you have to do is hit that fifth star, or whatever number of stars you would like to give us, but, you know, we prefer on the upper end. But if you want to leave us a review and tell people why you listen to the show, even if you're listening by accident and you've made it this far through the episode, tell people why. Did you fall asleep?
If you've listened this far and the whole thing is an accident, don't worry. I'm sure the emergency medical technicians will be with you shortly. Right. And they'll be able to turn off your computer and you won't have to listen to any more.
And they will erase any memory, any evidence that you ever had anything to do with us. But if you could go to iTunes and leave us a review, that would really help us out. So feel free to do that. Of course, you're welcome to leave us comments on any of the sites that you encounter us on, whether it's in SoundCloud, whether it's on our website, ihearofsherlock.com, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, wherever. And of course, we still have the option for you to become a patron. Mm-hmm. Patreon.com/ihearofsherlock, or just our homepage. Hit that orange Become a Patron button. You will join the likes of Mary Miller. Mary Miller, who recently, get this, met Brent Spiner, also known as Commander Data from Star Trek, or as the homeless guy Bob from Night Court, if you go back that far. That was one of my favorite roles of his, actually. But Mary met Brent Spiner. Mary, of course, is a patron of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. And the reason we're giving her a shout-out is because she is so generous with her time and comments and money, most importantly. But she met Brent Spiner, and we had hoped that she would become an ambassador for I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere and ask him if he would like to be interviewed. But alas, I guess the handler shuffled Mary off before she could utter another word. Yeah. So either that or she goosed him and they just got her out of the building right away. I don't know. I don't know if I put that past her.
Well, Mary is always resourceful, so we can count on her in a pinch. So I suppose that's perfectly appropriate.
In a pinch, not too pinch.
In a pinch.
Indeed. Well, and of course, if you're wondering what's happening on episode 97, we have a little preview here for you if you want to get in the mood. Recently, we had occasion to visit Sydney, Australia, on business. And as any good Sherlockian knows, when you go to Sydney, there's no escaping without first visiting with the Sydney passengers.
Yeah, they were landed at Sydney, where Armitage and Evans changed their names to Trevor and Beddoes, and then went on to become prosperous and powerful men who only in their lives made one more mistake.
They came back to England.
Yes, exactly.
As a kid, I was a Marvel Comics nut. And in 76, Marvel Comics came out with a thing called Marvel Preview featuring Sherlock Holmes.
There's a two-parter.
Two-parter.
Right?
And I bought the second one of those in the newsagent at Ashfield in a Western Sydney. And that was it. I was gone. Not only was Sherlock Holmes a movie and book character, but he was a Marvel Comics character. At least then I got obsessed. I was going to Abbey's bookshop and other bookshops and reading every spin-off that was coming out in the late 70s. And started hearing about Scion societies, and I was fascinated by those. And then, like you, Kerry, sometime in the early to mid-80s, I think, there was a note in Abby's bookshop that Bill Cornell had put up saying interested people can get in contact. And, there's a Sydney-based Sherlock Holmes Society.
A truly incredible tale. Transportation, mutiny, murder, powder kegs, fortunes, aliases, blackmail. I can hardly believe it.
Even so, the tale was interesting, Doctor. And its interest, surely, that is the very key to life.
So, gird yourself for a trip down under when I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere comes back for episode 97, which will air on May 30th. Stay tuned for that.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Well, until then, I suppose with a spring in my step.
Oh, boing.
I am Scott Monty.
Yes, and I'm Bert Wolder, and together we observe somewhat pedantically the games afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.